I'm Christopher Lydon with an open source invitation. The astonishing cabaret singer and heartthrob Amanda Palmer and I are hanging out in Harvard Square on the Monday night after Thanksgiving, talking songs and life, and maybe her song about me. And of course, we want you to join us. Go to radioopensource.org for details and tickets. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It's Mark Zuckerberg's world, people, and we're just Facebook users in it. 2 billion of us now, a quarter of all humanity. We are the unpaid production staff of the fourth most valuable company in Silicon Valley, which means in the U.S. And the whole idea, born in a Harvard dormitory, isn't 15 years old yet. The notion was, make the campus, then the world, more open and connected. Blink. And Facebook is the universal place to like and be liked, to friend as a verb. Blink again, and it's the tailored news feed that's market researching us, same time it's advertising to us. Add video, and it's the new television, with a grip on our attention like nothing since television. It may be a new version of democracy. Some say a new religion. We're taking a second look this hour at the Facebook phenomenon. For sudden size and audacity, it is something new under the sun. And it keeps transforming itself like a teenager, which it is. 14 years ago, Facebook was a social network for college kids that became a mind-reading marketing tool, and then an advertising engine, and now a main gateway to media and ideas and politics for 2 billion users. But Facebookers are, in truth, more used than users. Subscribers write the text and take the pictures that make the interest in Facebook before they become the product that is sold to the advertisers, which is just one of many odd wrinkles getting noticed in Congress and elsewhere recently. The Economist from London this week turns the Facebook logo into a smoking gun under the headline, "Social Media's Threat to Democracy." One of our guests this hour is finishing a book that will picture Facebook as the anti-social network, an instrument of division, not community building. We begin with a 50-year backstory in Silicon Valley and a zigzag path of big ideas hand in hand with super high tech. Fred Turner at Stanford gets us started. He's a recovering journalist who writes hardcover history now of what was really happening, like his account of how California counterculture in the summer of love 50 years ago became cyberculture and digital utopianism. Welcome, Fred Turner. We thought Facebook was booming, but what about that larger utopia? Is it in trouble? Welcome, Fred Turner.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here. I don't know if it's in trouble. You know, the Facebook that we see today is the product of a 60-year dream that's really born in the engineering world of MIT, right during and just after World War II. A man named Norbert Wiener and the cybernetics crew around him dream of a world in which we can surround people with media, let them be free in the circles of media that we build for them, and let them interact with one another. And somehow, just by building the system around them, we will manage them. It's a kind of managerial vision. That vision migrates to California and becomes an engine of the counterculture. And the counterculture dreams of a world in which we can let politics go, we can just embrace one another in a kind of shared celebration of consciousness. And so long as we do that, we'll build a new and better world.
High hippiedom.
high hippiedom, absolutely. And that ethos actually still infects Facebook today. I've actually spent a fair amount of time over there. And, you know, you can feel that kind of optimism and that hopefulness that all we need to do is connect, just connect. We don't need to legislate. We don't need to regulate. We need to just connect. And that's a deeply countercultural dream.
I've been wondering, even since we talked, Fred, where was Marshall McLuhan in all this?
You know, Marshall McLuhan was very much a utopian, but he was sort of a mass media utopian. He really hoped that television would be a sort of, you know, make us all a global village, and that in that global village we could look at one another and, on the screen and be free. He didn't imagine the piece that the hippies imagined and that Mark Zuckerberg has very much brought to life, and that's a piece in which we interact with each other and try to literally share minds. We leave our bodies behind, enter some kind of mind space, in this case the Facebook interface, in the hope of coming to some kind of truer understanding than is possible in the embodied world. That's something Marshall McLuhan hadn't quite dreamed up, but the hippies of the 60s out here in San Francisco really worked, and that Mark Zuckerberg is putting to the test now.
You know, I've lived a large part of that era, and I'm trying to remember now, what were the ideals of a social democracy that talked to itself and each other? I mean, are we talking, you know, Socrates and Agora in Athens? Are we talking 18th century London or revolutionary America, even Boston in the 1770s or what?
Well, we're really talking the Trips Festival. In 1966, people gather in San Francisco, they drop acid, and they hope in a festival together to achieve a sort of condition of ecstatic communion. And ecstatic communion is really sort of what it's all about out here. You know, the Valley, despite being in California, is suffused with a kind of deep Protestant hopefulness, a kind of millenarianism, a sense that if we just do the right thing and God rewards us, we'll be made wealthy and our wealth will be an emblem of our goodness and we'll all be fine. But out of the 60s, remember, two very different ideas of politics emerged. One we associate with the New Left, wanting to change politics to do politics to change politics, sort of marching against the war, that kind of thing. The other, a kind of commune-based new communalism, and that's the wing that feeds into the tech world. It's a wing that says politics is bankrupt. What we need to do is find the right small-scale technologies, stereos, LSD, and later computers, and use those to change our minds. And then once we can do that, we can get our minds together in some kind of ecstatic condition, and that will be better than politics. That will, in fact, be utopia.
Who were their models?
You know, it's interesting. Their models were different kinds of folks. In the 60s, they had models like Buckminster Fuller, who was a kind of peripatetic genius of the middle of the 20th century, patented the geodesic dome, was probably one of the only men over 30 widely trusted in the counterculture. He had a notion, for example, that all we had to do was valve the products of mainstream American industry into tools for individual personal transformation. And if we did that, we would come up with a kind of technocratic utopia. His ideas flooded the counterculture. There were other folks, too, folks like Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson, and most of all, Norbert Wiener, which is a kind of counterintuitive thing because he was a military-industrial researcher, a mathematician, an MIT professor, exactly the kind of person you wouldn't think would be associated with the counterculture. But his dream of a world connected by technical systems, by especially computational and information systems, a dream he had as early as 48, 49, 50, is also a dream that animated the counterculture.
Did you ever feel you were looking at it? There it is. That's what it's going to be like. And it works.
In which context? Looking back at Norbert Wiener or looking at the present?
No, looking at California culture over the last 30, 40 years. You say, that person gets it. Or there's our leader. Or there's the newspaper or the anything.
No. On the contrary, what I see is a kind of a dream that sort of hovers right below the awareness of all kinds of different people, and people can kind of plug into it at their own pace. You can see it in the novel The Circle. You can see it in Apple's new headquarters, which
Jay
is
Vegas.
A monstrous, gigantic donut. You know, you can see this dream of a kind of circular polis permeating the valley. I don't think any one person owns it, but I think lots of people are trying to leverage it.
Fred Cherney, you have a wonderful air of irony in your voice, as if to say it was also interesting and also nutty. Account for that. I mean, did you ever take it seriously?
I took it very seriously. I entered the study of the counterculture hoping and believing that it really was a counterculture. One of the things that shocked me when I got inside it was how much it was already a mainstream culture. It embraced technology. It embraced commerce as a mechanism of social change. And it was all already in place here. I think the other thing that surprised me was the depth of its allegiance to the deepest American ideals. You know, I as I walk around Silicon Valley today, I often think that I'm walking around something like, Plymouth in 1620. You know, this is a city in which people are dreaming of a kind of all-American utopian alternative, a community of saints whose abilities are unique and whose achievements are recognized by almost cosmic levels of wealth.
Wow. Listen, something's happened, and it's the business of this hour to try to define it. It's happening to Facebook right this moment. And the easy story, the one that Congress can play with, maybe the silly story, is that Facebook's news feed let the Russians spook our 2016 election. I don't want to go there. But the more interesting puzzle for me in the long view and you're our long view, Fred, is how the disruptions that came with digital media, like Facebook, like Twitter, opened the territory for the most awful presidential contest that any of us can remember. I mean, what are the connections here? I don't want to be personal, but go ahead.
Sure. There are a couple of different connections. One is almost pre-digital, and it goes back to the counterculture. Counterculture very much hoped to build a society shaped around kind of individual identity. And in many ways, systems like Facebook or Twitter were designed by their original creators to produce the kind of society the counterculture called for, a society in which identity was the primary key to politics, in which all politics were personal and the personal was always public and political. So in some sense, these systems represent an anti-institutional, highly individualistic dream from the counterculture that's come to life successfully.
Mm-hmm.
But therein lies one of the curses of the counterculture. You know, I studied communes, and I was shocked. I thought that they would be wide-open, collaborative environments. On the contrary, they tended to be, in the 60s, conservative, white, male-dominated, heteronormative, often inadvertently, sort of implicitly racist. They were, in many ways, the embodiment of the worst of America's suburbs at the time. And you can see that happening now in the contemporary space. You can see a highly individuated environment and the institutions that sustain that environment kind of melting away, and you see individual voices coming up instead. On the communes, individual voices led to charismatic leadership and the abuse of those who lacked charisma. In the world of Twitter and Facebook, you can see folks like Donald Trump willing to invoke a kind of charisma that we once associated with the authoritarianism of the mid-century in terms that are very personal, individual, emotive. Donald Trump wears his emotions on his sleeve just like a, you know, a good teenage girl might tweet. But he also wears his emotions on his sleeve as the leader of the free world. And in that context, he feels more like Mussolini than a hippie.
You can see Bernie Sanders emerging in some fashion out of these conditions that you're describing. But how did the media transformation condition lay down the conditions for the embarrassment of the Hillary-Donald final? I mean,
I think one of the key pieces, actually, is ironically one of the things that Facebook does best, and some of your other guests can probably talk about this in more detail. Facebook is an individuation machine. It works very hard to make sure that the news that comes to you is particular to your interests. And in that context, it tends to amplify things that you may be interested in but that actually have no truth value. And I think that, in turn, created a condition in which it's much harder to have the kind of shared community that Facebook claimed to be building. A highly individuated world is a world that leaves people disconnected from one another and vulnerable to the kind of charisma that Donald Trump has exhibited.
We're going to come back to this highly individuated world. Fred Turner is our historian of the current in Silicon Valley. His most recent book is The Democratic Surround, Multimedia and American Liberalism from World War II to the psychedelic 60s. And we're coming back to you, Fred. Coming up, the human design and the social effects inside those Facebook algorithms. This is Open Source. Facebook is our case study on the foggy landscape of digital capitalism, an area marked by novelty, mystery, non-regulation, giant growth, amazing profits, compound social effects, and now anxiety. Siva Vaidyanathan studies and teaches all of it at the University of Virginia, and he writes widely about the law and the tech of public conversation. Siva, I want you and everyone to get a taste of Facebook's pitch in a TV ad about itself and some of the things it is like, starting with chairs.
Chairs. Anyone can sit on a chair. And if the chair is large enough, they can sit down together and tell jokes or make up stories or just listen. Chairs are for people, and that is why chairs are like Facebook.
It's not just chairs, Sivas. Facebook is like airplanes, bridges, dance floors, where people confirm that they are not alone in the universe. Siva Vaidyanathan, I take it that your work in progress on Facebook, about Facebook, is going to be titled The Anti-Social Network. Tell us about it.
It's going to be called Anti-Social Media. It'll be out in in August or September of 2018. It's an account of the ways that Facebook scrambles so many important areas of our life. It scrambles our social context. It's turned our commercial worlds upside down in some important ways, especially in the ways it affects journalism. And perhaps most importantly, it's scrambled our political lives. It's rendered us incapable of thinking collaboratively and collectively about the problems we face in the world.
It sounds like a direct connection to 2016. And I don't want to get into Trump or Hillary personally, but in what way did it condition that campaign?
Well, see, I actually think we might make a mistake by starting with the United States in 2016. We can take that as the moment when America woke up to the propagandistic power of Facebook and the biases within it. And when I say biases, I don't want you to think about biases toward a particular political orientation. It's actually a set of biases against deep thought, against deliberation. Facebook, as we've seen, we saw it through movement after movement after movement, is an excellent tool for motivation. It's a terrible tool for deliberation. Unfortunately, as we move more and more of our political lives, spend more and more of our time engaged with this platform, and it has reached 2.1 billion people around the world, we are undermining our ability to exercise our political minds in potentially edifying ways, right? We're getting farther and farther away from a place we've always wanted to be and never really were, that place where we could agree to disagree, or we could compromise, or we could at least agree on the facts of a situation or diagnose a problem and then move forward even if we disagree about the potential solutions. That's how a republic's supposed to work. That is how deliberative politics around the world is supposed to work. We've seen the real pernicious effects of this, not in the United States, not yet. We've seen it in places like Ukraine, in places like Poland and Hungary, in places like India, in the Philippines, and most recently in Myanmar, as the forces that are instigating the public passions against the Rohingya minority in Myanmar are exploiting people's feelings largely through Facebook and WhatsApp, which is one of Facebook's most used services. So
you like to say, Siva, that the algorithms inside that little box tilt toward extremes of all kinds. Yeah. What does that mean?
Right. So, you know, look, Facebook's quite open about this. What matters on Facebook, what carries on Facebook, what shows up most frequently in your newsfeed or my newsfeed are things that generate what people at Facebook call engagement, likes, clicks, comments, etc., shares, right? Those are the records of engagement. Things that generate the most engagement are, unsurprisingly, things that trigger strong emotions. So what carries the farthest and the fastest on Facebook? Well, puppies and baby pictures and hate speech, right? To name three out of any number of things that move, that really move emotions, right? So the other thing to remember about Facebook is the more visual elements in it, or the more powerfully visual the content is, the more likely Facebook's algorithm is going to favor it. That's a very explicit bias that Facebook has been pushing. It's one of the reasons that journalistic institutions are laying off people who actually write sentences and hiring people who might hack together video. It's really important for things to carry on Facebook. Now, what happens when visuality and powerful emotions rule a major source, and in many parts of the world, the major source for how we learn about our world and our community, which is completely true in a place like Myanmar or the Philippines, where Facebook is the dominant media force. Wow. It's very true in a place like India, where it's increasingly important, and it's also true in the United States, but less so. Now, what happens then is we get drawn into propaganda. We get drawn into mis and disinformation campaigns that are so easy to launch, so inexpensive to promote. And that's the problem. Like if we had no Facebook and we sat down and we wanted to design a machine, a system to distribute propaganda for nationalist movements or for authoritarian leaders, we could not do better than Facebook. We would basically have to invent Facebook.
Steve, stand by for a sec. We got a different slant on Facebook this week from, in some sense, a rival entrepreneur. Paul Budnitz in Vermont built the community site Hello, like hello without the H, for artists and their friends. Their rule was no ads on the site and no collection of user data. He marked the moment when Mark Zuckerberg took another path.
Things really changed, obviously, when Facebook announced that they were going to have advertisement. And they really changed when the company decided that the feed or the timeline, that is the stuff you see when you use Facebook, would no longer be chronologic. And you would no longer see everything that is actually from the people that you follow. Instead, a computer algorithm will decide what you see. Yeah.
Can I just say, I thought till recently, Paul, that I was seeing the jottings of all different kinds of friends, railroad conductors, friends of my children, relatives, as they posted.
Right. Well, you're not. What you're seeing is a selection of stuff that was posted by your friends that this algorithm, this computer program, thinks that you would like. And basically, the algorithm's job is to get you to stay on Facebook. The goal isn't for you to have a good time, actually, and the goal isn't for you to connect with friends or hear about new events. The goal is to keep you on Facebook as long as possible. That is to have the largest share of your daily attention, because the longer that you're on Facebook, the more data they can grab about you and the more ads they can show you, which are the two ways they make money.
Explain, Paul, that the user base keeps growing, but also the time on Facebook keeps growing.
Yeah, that's correct. And it does because that's sort of the social engineering that's the goal of the company, obviously. They're really engineering an experience that is as addictive as possible. Oreo cookies is the great example because, you know, Oreos are awesome and they taste really good. But the thing about Oreos is that they have actually been engineered by food scientists to be addictive, right? Oreos aren't just sweet, they're also salty. And there's a certain combination of that that food scientists have discovered is like extremely addictive and incredibly hard to stop eating once you start. The issue with something like Facebook is that they're doing the same thing. They're engineering your experience to make it very difficult for you to go away. They're trying to feed you stuff that they think you're interested in. And that seems kind of innocuous until you realize that, I would just put it this way, the people in Virginia who just voted, if you're on the left wing, your experience on Facebook is going to be completely different than if, let's say, you're right wing and your experience on Facebook. And what Facebook can do is help people drill down just to the people who might be interested in more right wing stuff. But the algorithm is also sorting out the content that you get. So really, like online, we're living in completely different worlds. And that's one of the reasons there's so much division right now between us.
That was Paul Budnitz in Vermont, who was crushed in a certain sense by the success of Facebook, but is still a happy, interactive artist at home in Vermont. Siva, back to you for a sec. All of these effects, and Budnitz is good about it, are written into the code, the algorithms in some sense, but how much of it was design? And whose interest would it be to have a social network that atomizes communities?
Well, look, when the engineers at Zuckerberg's behest designed Facebook, they weren't thinking about it in those terms. In fact, Zuckerberg often explains the goal of Facebook in very opposite terms, very different terms, that it's about connecting people and joining groups. And, you know, it's very, in his mind, very collaborative. And the problem is, in practice, it's just the opposite, because he's designed a system that does just the opposite. He's designed a system that rewards us with what we have told Facebook we already like, and rewards the content that generates the most reaction. And the combination of our own homophily, our own willingness to only engage with things that, you know, convince us that we actually are really smart and understand the world, and make us feel good, right? Our own homophily is amplified by Facebook's algorithms in some dangerous ways. So, you know, part of the problem is we're going to tend toward homophily. But then when you put us in front of this, you know, I love that Oreo analogy, this, you know, junk food machine that will give us more and more Oreos. We are going to keep hitting the little button for more and more Oreos. Now, just like Facebook is engineered to be Oreo-like, Facebook is actually explicitly engineered to be much like fruit machines or slot machines or poker machines in a casino. And so many Silicon Valley firms, app designs are based on those very same principles to keep us coming back, to give us this very low level of pressure, like a pleasure, like a Skinner box, you know, like B.F. Skinner would have imagined. Like, you know, right now, B.F. Skinner would look at Facebook and say, aha, see, I told you so.
Interesting.
You know, we conditioned 2.1 billion people to keep going back and hitting that button for that, just that little bit of pleasure. That minimal bit of pleasure, because you rarely go to Facebook and suddenly feel wonderful throughout the day, but you keep going back to Facebook.
Yeah, we're going to ask Fred.
You're missing something.
We're going to ask Fred Turner about that. There's a high behaviorist nightmare in this thing, too. But I want to introduce Moira Gallagher Weigel. This year, she co-founded a new magazine called Logic, centered on technology, but focused in the first three issues on intelligence, then sex, then justice. Her first book was A History of Dating. Don't know how you do it, Moira, but I couldn't help noticing in a Guardian article last week on the troubles in Silicon Valley, you wrote, "We are watching an entire worldview start to fall apart."
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for reading my Guardian long read. it does feel that way. It does feel that way at this moment to me. I think over the past year, and particularly over the past 6 months in the media and among politicians, it seems there's been this sea change in feelings about Facebook and the big tech platforms in general. I will say consumer attitudes don't reflect the same shift. I think the most recent polling still shows approval of Facebook, Google, and Amazon at like 60, 82, 88% respectively. But it does seem as if in our media discourse, there's been this dramatic change from the optimism after the Obama election, for instance, if you think of that time as like a real point of contrast.
Yeah, I mean, it's the numbers are the numbers, but the worldview is what I'm curious about. What have we lost that we really liked? Or are we coming to our senses in toward another worldview?
Well, I think, and I speak with great respect of this before Fred, because I think Fred is the great expert on this. But I think that what's interesting to me about ideology, you know, about certain sets of beliefs that dovetail and flow together, is that they only become visible as ideology rather than just like truth or common sense in moments of crisis. And what I think we're seeing and what I tried to speak to in that article is the unraveling of this set of interlinking assumptions about what was good. So, for instance, the idea that facilitating individuation and individual expression in the way that Fred talked about was an absolute sort of autotelic good. The idea that absence of moderation or control was a good, the idea that giving people more opportunities to connect was a good, and that this would all be good for American business and democracy, conveniently also for making money for the owners of the platforms that facilitated such behavior. I think that these ideas sort of flowed together and reinforced one another and didn't appear ideological, seemed like common sense for decades, and that as a result of a variety of things that have come together over the past year, in the United States anyway, have started to come into question.
This gets very philosophical, almost theological. What was the flaw looking back at all these convergences? Where was the sin? Where was the human pride, a deep mistake?
Yeah, I think I'm glad we're taking it to theology since you've called me by my Irish Catholic mother's middle name. I think that it, for me, the central thing that's coming into question is this belief that absence of regulation and free markets oriented towards the profit motive are always a good, and that the interests of these large private companies coincide with the interests of mankind in general and of American democracy. And I think that at least among the folks I was writing about in the piece you're talking about, among, you know, in the pages of Logic, we're starting to see younger people and people across the board questioning the idea that, you know, optimizing for engagement because that's what will make Facebook money is always also in the best interests of, say, the American people, not to mention the people of Myanmar or other folks Siva was talking about.
What would your mother be saying?
I don't think she knows how to use Facebook. I saw this.
Well, she's been spared then. But what would she say? Moira, I could have told you there was something silly or over-consuming. I mean, if it were my mother, there would be a puritanical sort of shaking of the finger, too. But what would she say we've learned?
Gosh, I don't know what my mother would say we've learned. I mean, I think to pivot to some of the young folks I've spent more time talking about this with, I think that a lot of engineers and people I've interviewed who work in the Valley or work in the tech industry were drawn to it because they bought into the set of ideals that Fred was describing, you know, these ideas of increasing personal liberation or intensifying interpersonal communication. And I think for them, this process of crisis or disillusionment has been quite painful in many cases and also quite radicalizing. I'll have to ask my own mother what she'd have to say. I'm not sure.
You're talking about symptoms of the end of the 60s and maybe in California in a particular way, a sort of an end of some sort of airy hedonism and sort of, you know, when hippiedom went silly or are we reliving that sort of a crash?
What I think of it as is when hippiedom went corporate, sort of when, you know, Silicon Valley, and again, Fred is the great master of this story, but when the counterculture fed into the cyberculture and discovered it was a gold mine, that was a view that dominated for decades. And it seems to me that's what's kind of cracking or unraveling, starting to come into question.
Not so the belief so much as the equation with money and incredible profits that tell you there's something wrong with this picture. Maybe. Is that what you mean?
I think, I'm not sure it's compatible with democracy. I don't know. I think that it's a very complicated and big question.
Maura Gallagher-Weigel will be back. Coming up, Mark Zuckerberg, after all, 13 years after starting Facebook, 7 years in recovery from that movie he doesn't like, Social Network. This is Open Source. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg returned this past spring to give the commencement speech at Harvard, where he had dropped out as a sophomore to develop his mightily contested prototype. Face, figure, and haircut still boyish. He summed up an idealistic vision as of old.
This is the struggle of our time. The forces of freedom, openness, and global community against the forces of authoritarianism, isolationism, and nationalism. Forces for the flow of knowledge, trade, and immigration against those who would slow them down. This is not a battle of nations. It is a battle of ideas. And this is my story, too. A student in a dorm, connecting one community at a time, and keeping at it until one day we can connect the whole world.
That was Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard in May. Are you blushing, Moira?
Woof, no, I'm just remembering my face on face mashup, connecting one face at a time. First, he was encouraging people to make fun of young women's faces. That's all.
I want to hear from everybody, starting with you, Siva, about Mark Zuckerberg himself. I keep meeting people who think he's running for president, visiting every state, all that sort of thing, and maybe imagining that he knows how to hack an election for himself.
Not at all. Not at all. Look, he already runs Facebook. Why would he run for president? He's everything we know about him. And believe me, I've read almost everything I could find that he has written and said publicly. I've watched thousands of his hours of his speeches, if there are that many. I think I might be exaggerating. The fact is, he's a deeply sincere person who's committed to what he sees as the transformative power of his technology and his company. That's unwavering. He sees the potential positive effects of Facebook influencing government and politics as the best way to help the world. And this is his problem, right? He actually deeply believes that he is doing more good than harm, and that his company and his technology are going to be able to lift people out of darkness and bring them together in a positive way. In the absence of any evidence, and in the presence of a tremendous amount of evidence to the contrary, evidence doesn't matter, because this is a deeply religious belief for him. It's one he is quite articulate about. He's also a deeply sincere person, as well as being a brilliant person. So being brilliant and sincere, he has been trying to come to terms with some dissonance. After the 2016 election, he faced dissonance. He faced the fact that he went on the record saying that Facebook had very little, if any, influence on the election, only to quickly find out that his own staff thought otherwise, and then seeing the fact that the rest of the world turned around on that as well.
It's funny to me, Siva, that religion keeps crowding in. He's almost, strikes me as an almost religious engineer. The religion of engineering, it works. Look what I can do. Hey.
Again, if I may footnote Fred on this, right? Fred has done the deep work to connect the almost theological, although, you know, it's often espoused as spiritual, roots of that culture, which, look, it allows you to suspend all disbelief. It allows you to believe deeply in yourself and in the transformative power of these machines that glow, and the power of the ether through which data flows. And once you believe in that transformative power, even if you are thinking through the code logically, ultimately you're making that leap. And this is a habit, and it's a it's actually almost a catechism that flows in that community. It's one that he joined at a very young age.
Right? Let me say, it's a cue to Fred Turner to explain this faith, this religion.
Well, I think the deep American story is actually the story mirrored by Mark Zuckerberg's migration from Cambridge, the home of American Puritanism, or a home of American Puritanism in the 17th century, to Silicon Valley, which is where American Puritan ideals live today. You know, the hope that an individual could not just make good, but could make something cosmically good, that they could express something deeply spiritual inside themselves and make visible a kind of communal elect is something that I think Zuckerberg brought with him and that resonated very deeply out here. I do want to touch on something that Moira was getting at, too, which I think is very important, which is the end of the counterculture. One of the things that we're seeing in the Valley now is the fading away of the generation that brought us a lot of these technologies. You know, we're 14, 15 years out from the founding of Facebook. We're, 30 years out almost from the beginning of the Internet. And we're 50 years out from the rise of the personal computer. What's happening is that 60s generation that helped tell us computers were tools of countercultural utopianism is melting away. What's taking their place are programmers, people very much, much more in a gold rush mold, who have come out here with the explicit purpose of making money. And so I think that's another factor in the kind of crumbling of the ideology that Moira pointed us to. The only other piece I wanted to touch on, too, and I think this is also important, is that, you know, Zuckerberg talks about community, but he's very careful to retain sole control of his shares. You know, the way that company is structured, he has a kind of individual mandate. It's a public company in name only. He can decide how those shares are voted. He has the ultimate say, and he can make choices that are against the will of the shareholders. That's written into the design of the firm. I think there's a sort of tension around what individual leadership ought to be that lives inside Facebook. One last thought. You know, we imagine from Puritan times on through the counterculture that individuating our expression would be the foundation of a kind of democratic collaboration. And what we see instead is something that maybe Mark Zuckerberg doesn't believe, but we can see it happening, where that individuation leads not to democratic collaboration, but instead opens the door to kind of authoritarian charisma. It's contrary to a longstanding American dream. It's contrary to the hope that if we just decentralized media, got rid of mass media, we would free up Americans to be collaborative, open individuals. And I think it's something that Mark Zuckerberg may not yet be able to fully acknowledge in his own life or his own company.
Listen, everybody, our assignment in the next 10 minutes is to specify exactly what is coming down. But something is happening to the Valley, as you say, Fred, and to Facebook in particular. Maureen Dowd of The Times, her finger ever on the zeitgeist, is writing Jaron Lanier's furious farewell to all that, to the matrix coming out of your computer. And Sean Parker, who was the first president of Facebook, is denouncing the whole project as a giant exercise in narcissism and manipulation. Listen to this.
It's a social validation feedback loop. I mean, it's exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. You know, and it's me, it's Mark, it's Kevin Systrom at Instagram, it's all of these people understood this consciously, and we did it anyway.
Sean Parker was the obnoxious Justin Timberlake character in that movie, Social Network. He referred to himself this week as something of a conscientious objector now on social media. Fred Turner, you begin, but I want to hear from everybody. What is burning out here, and why now?
Well, you know, that behavioralist nudge urge, it was in fact part of a deep dream from the mid-century among engineers. If we could just engineer a system of nudges in which we could kind of paternalistically nudge people to act in their own best interests, we would free them from themselves. That hope is still alive here, and that's one of the things that terrifies me going forward, is that we will continue to build nudge systems ostensibly to produce benevolent behavior, but clearly in ways that will be shaped by advertising and other forces. I think the dream of disembodied communal democracy that animated the Puritans in the 17th century and animated Silicon Valley certainly in the 80s, 90s, and early aughts has just got to be seen as a failure on the ground. The city on a hill isn't glowing. Mm. It doesn't work. And we need to think about how to build cities that are built around collaborations across difference, built around institutions that support and maintain the kinds of worlds that we want to be in. I think the disembodied community dream that Jaron Lanier once promoted and that others have promoted, that is something that very few people can still believe in.
It's funny, Cass Sunstein, Harvard Law professor, wrote a book called Nudge just recently, sort of ways that government maybe can help you do the
right thing.
Yeah,
he's defending a mode of paternalism that's deeply engineering-centric. You know, this is a deep engineering dream. If we just build the system right, people can live inside it in ways that they wouldn't be able to live without it. And I think that can become a bit of an apology for the kind of thing that Facebook has become.
Maura Weigel, you're shaking your head in all sorts of directions here. What's next?
Oh, gosh, I was also just thinking of my dad telling me about Nudge every time I talked to him on the phone recently. Literally paternalistic. But I think, to jump in, one thing that was quite interesting listening to that Zuckerberg commencement speech, and also thinking, as a woman on the internet can't help but do, about Peter Thiel and Curtis Yarvin, who goes by Mencius Moldbug online, and all these sort of nasty alt-right men, is how in both cases there's sort of this great man theory of history that's at work for them. I was laughing when Siva was saying, I forget how exactly you put it, but, you know, why would Zuckerberg want to be president? It's like a step down from leading Facebook. I think that there are many ways in which it seems we're on the edge almost of some kind of post-democratic situation in all kinds of ways, as regards private property, as regards nation states, as regards culture. But one thing that's quite striking is how this great man notion that Fred evoked so vividly on the commune seems to have persisted in both its right and left incarnations, and how deeply anti-democratic it is. I mean, even if Zuckerberg believes he's sort of a messianic figure and he intends for his 7 billion person community, whatever that would mean, a community of the whole world, to be a good place or to be utopian, it's not a democratic idea he's espousing.
Mara, what is your picture of a new feudalism? I picture all these giant corporations, I mean, 5-10 of them, in their castles around the world, and everybody else is outside the moat. What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, one can't help but think of Game of Thrones and how all of America is addicted to this this version of it, where eventually the VCs get brought to justice or something. I think that there's a way in which our activities on these platforms and the nature of platform capitalism resembles something like feudalism more than it resembles the forms of capitalism associated with liberal democracies and nation states. When we think about just think about us all on these platforms. You know, we're not mixing our labor with the land and making private property, as John Locke would have once described it. We're getting a bunch of use values. We're getting to interact with friends and have certain kinds of emotional experiences. We're generating value for someone else that we don't own. It's not our property. What happens on the back end, what's done with our conversations or our likes. So anyway, I think that's one aspect of it. I think the lack of democratic control, sort of a lack of transparency around the algorithms and the platforms is part of it. I think also the significant, I mean, these concentrations of private power and private ownership of public, formerly public infrastructure that has significant power to disrupt the operations of the nation state is quite significant. I mean, the funniest part of watching the Senate hearings to me, at risk of sounding pessimistic, was how little it seems any of those politicians can do about it.
Interesting. Siva, can you imagine a world after Facebook? Have you seen it yet?
No, I can't. And I can't imagine, like Morris said, I mean, I think that was very insightful. There's not much anybody can do about it. We've heard over the last few months, and we will continue to hear suggestions, proposals, promises, both from Washington and from Facebook, to tweak and fix and try to damp down the negative externalities of this phenomenon. But the fact is, Facebook is working exactly as it was designed. The problem with Facebook is Facebook. If you're going to take the three core elements of Facebook, the fact that anybody can join and push material out there, that the algorithms will favor the emotionally powerful and visually striking over almost any other sentiment, and an advertising system that is self-service and highly targeted based on demographic and personality attributes, you combine those three things, which is everything Facebook is and all that Facebook is, and you are going to create a propaganda machine, a machine that divides people, that angers people, that frustrates people, that carries messages that are the sorts of things that we spent much of the 20th century trying to get beyond.
Until when, Siva? Does it stop? When does somebody
Doesn't. It doesn't until Zuckerberg pulls the plug and he has no incentive to pull the plug. This is something Americans hate to hear. There is nothing we can do about this.
Moira.
So Chris, oh, sorry.
Fred Turner, please.
So I just want to jump in on the nothing we can do about it part. I generally agree with Siva in all things, but on this one, I disagree.
Good.
I think we may be at a moment in social media, much like we were in with the early trusts in the oil industry. We might be in a Carnegie, Ford, Rockefeller kind of era. We were very much able to break up the trusts. And if what we see in Google and Apple and Facebook are essentially emerging trusts for our social good, then we can still act with the mechanisms that we've always had. We should not give up the ability to govern ourselves or to use states to take what are essentially very important and increasingly important infrastructures back for the social good. So I do think it's possible to interrupt what is essentially a commercial industrial process, much as we have with earlier ones in the 19th century.
Moira.
Yeah, I agree with Fred on this. I think there's so much interesting energy around tech antitrust, so I didn't mean to suggest that nobody can do anything. And I want, in addition to folks like, Lena Khan and Sabil Rahman and Matt Stoller and scholars who are talking about the antitrust approach, I do also think that a lot of folks who work in the industry, a significant and growing number of them.
I was going to say, what can people, including the workers at Facebook, do to put pressure on their own company?
Well, I think they have a lot of ways to put pressure on their own company. I think their engineers have a pretty powerful position still within these companies. Their management practices, like the weekly meeting that everyone goes to, where anyone can ask a question of Zuckerberg, that can be useful for political pressure. I've interviewed, spent a lot of time with, and written about these members of this group, Tech Workers Coalition and Tech Action, which is a group with the Democratic Socialists of America, many of whom work at Google and Facebook and at these big companies, who are very invested in trying to instill more democratic control over what's happening there, and very troubled by what they've seen since the election. I think the split between the VCs and CEOs, who almost always get to tell the story of technology in the media, is a very different story than the story that might be told by many of the engineers who work for them, many of whom tilt far to the left of the people they work for, as is true of my generation in general. So I think there's hope in the engineers.
The stakes here are so huge. You know, Scott Galloway writes in a new book about the four, meaning Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, and their remaking of the world. He writes, Are these entities the four horsemen of God, love, sex, and consumption, or are they the four horsemen of the apocalypse? Last words, Eva?
They're actually in a long effort to control the operating system of our lives. That's the right way to think about it. They're in a 10 to 20 year campaign to manage our data flows, our identities, and to encourage us to outsource decision making over everything from orange juice to politics. That's the danger on the horizon. That is their business model. That is their goal. They don't see it as pernicious, but for such a system to work, it's going to have to be standardized to the point that it actually leads to further conglomeration.
I cannot,
and a more powerful monopoly or duopoly than what we have now.
I just cannot believe, Siva, that people are going to allow themselves to be snuffed out of our humanity without a big fight. Meantime, thank you, Siva Vaidyanathan, Paul Budnitz, Moira Weigel, and Fred Turner. We want to hear more from you, Fred Turner. So delighted to meet you after all these years. If you're anywhere near Boston in 2 weeks, I will be hanging out with the astonishing cabaret singer and heartthrob Amanda Palmer, talking about songs and life, and maybe we'll hear her song about me. Please join us. The details are on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DeGregorio, Susan Coyne, George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our CEO. I'm Christopher Leidenman.